Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crown Town, Charlotte, North Carolina. Today we're going back just 100 years ago to the early days of Jewish people starting to pragmatically design their future. We'll look at Theodor Herzl's Alte Neuland, Boris Schatz's Utopian Jerusalem, E.M. Lillian's Zionist Art Nouveau, and the founding of the Bezalel School. And we're contrasting those hopeful blueprints against the anti-Semitic futures drawn in the pseudographic texts like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Let's get into it, y'all. So before we meet Theodor Herzl and E.M. Lillian and the Bezalel School, I want to slow down and let you feel the world that we're living in. We're in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. The soundscape and the skyline are changing almost month to month. Trains are cutting across Europe, compressing journeys that once took weeks into days. Telegraph wires are stitching cities together so that news, stock prices, political rumors move faster than people can. Electricity is starting to light up streets and homes, turning night into something you can push back with a switch. Photography is normal and present. Cinema is new and arriving. Newspapers and cheap pamphlets are everywhere. For Jews, this isn't just cool new tech. It's hitting at the same time as huge social and political upheavals. In parts of Western and Central Europe, Jews were gaining civil rights, entering universities, working in professions, moving into big cities. There's a feeling, at least for some, of possibility. Maybe we can finally belong, at least on paper. Maybe Berlin, Vienna, Paris can be home. In Eastern Europe, the picture looks very different. Jews are still fenced in by law and custom, stuck in the pale of settlement, facing poverty, restrictions on movement, violent outbreaks, and pogroms that can wipe out a town in a weekend. It's precarious. It's exhausting. It is very clear to a lot of people that their grandparents' way of life cannot simply roll forward untouched. And then there's this movement between the 1880s and the First World War. Millions of Jews leave to the United States, to South America, to Western Europe, and to Palestine. Communities that felt rooted for centuries in specific towns and shtetls suddenly became communities in transit. The old center of gravity is gone. At the same time, new Jewish political projects are coming online. Zionism says we need a national home, somewhere we can actually be a majority and build our own institutions. Socialists and Bundists say we need worker power and cultural autonomy right where we are. And religious movements scramble to hold on to halakha and Jewish time as factory whistles and streetcars rearrange the week and the workday. Overlay all that with the rise of modern anti-Semitism. This isn't just church sermons about stubborn Jews anymore. It's racial and conspiratorial stories that tie the Jew, quote-unquote, to modern finance, to media, to decay, and to secret plots. Newspapers and pamphlets are full of caricatures. Hooked-nosed bankers, spider-like figures spreading over the globe, stories about Jews corrupting nations from within. In the background of all this was what Europeans called the Jewish question, a cold way of asking whether or not Jews could ever really belong inside modern nation-states, and what to do with them if they didn't. Emancipation had opened doors on paper, but scandals like the Dreyfus Affair in 1894 and everyday prejudice against Jews kept reopening that old wound. For some Jews, the answer was fight for full equality right here, right now. For others, including Herzl, the answer became, if we're always going to be a question mark in somebody else's country, maybe we need to design a country of our own. So when we talk about early Jewish futurists in this episode, we're not talking about people casually daydreaming about the future. The future is a daily burning question. The old arrangements of life are breaking apart, and the same technologies that are transforming everyone's lives are available to Jews and to anti-Semites at the same time. For me, these figures first showed up in the same year, in two very different college courses of mine. One was a giant political science lecture with about 80 students, where Zionism and anti-Semitism were bullet points on a timeline. The other was my History of Graphic Design course, where we actually sat with images and objects. In that design class, I had space to ask, what does this poster feel like to me? What is this book trying to build in me? In the lecture hall, it was harder to dig in with my political science class. That contrast between a crowded room and a close reading is part of why I'm taking the time to slow this history down for you now. So most of us meet Theodor Herzl as some kind of postcard. He's a bearded, intense, leaning over the railing in Basel, looking towards the horizon kind of guy. I met him like that too, diluted in iconography. He was the guy on the poster, the father of modern political Zionism. End of story. And then Alta Neuland, his book, changed that for me when I started reading it as a futurist document. The premise is almost science fictional in its simplicity. Herzl imagines a pair of men leaving a Europe that feels hopeless, disappearing to a remote island, and then returning decades later to Palestine. They step into a future Jewish society and walk through it with us. Alta Neuland is written like a straight travel diary from the future. Herzl gives you this tired Viennese intellectual as your avatar, lands him in a rebuilt Jewish society, and walks you through it room by room. He doesn't just say, there's a Jewish state. He shows us the infrastructure, ports, power stations, public institutions, cooperative economic structures. He writes about how Jews and non-Jews live together side by side, how education works, what the culture looks like. The speculative tech is modest. Electric power, modern transit, big civic projects, but the radical piece is the social design. Public utilities run for the common good. Cooperative companies substitute for some of the raw capitalism he saw around him at his time. Cultural spaces are intentionally shared. It's kind of a civic UX, designing how a day in this world would actually feel. Amazing. Is it politically loaded? Of course. It is naive in places? Definitely. But it's deeply practical. Alta Neuland is Herzl using narrative as a simulation environment. He sets up this liminal world, he presses play, and asks, if we built this system, what kind of life would it create? What kinds of conflicts, what kinds of joys? He invites readers to walk through that simulation and asks you to judge it. I didn't come to Alta Neuland through literature class. I backed into it through Zionist history. I remember reading a short summary and feeling this weird spark inside. Here was a political idea smuggled into a novel, a whole nation-building exercise disguised as a story. Every design option was on the table. It felt less like a book I'm supposed to read, quote-unquote, and more like a sandbox I could play in. If we could redraw everything, what kind of Jewish world would we build? What an amazing, amazing question to ask. Now, I jumped from Vienna to Basel to a classroom much closer in time. I'm in college, sitting in a design history class. We had this super thick textbook by Philip Meggs, and if you are a graphic design student like me, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, you could use it as a step stool or a doorstop. You could prop your car up on the highway if you got a flat. In the epic darkness of the design history classroom, the projector is humming. The fluorescent lights are out, thank goodness, and my professor is marching us through the usual suspects of design. Victorian era, arts and crafts, the Belle Époque, and Art Nouveau. And then I hit this page that just absolutely makes me pause. There's a black and white illustration, all curves and ornament in that early 1900s Jugendstil style, which is German Art Nouveau. But the content is different. The figures look Jewish. The letters are Hebrew. The imagery is Zionist. The caption says something like, Ephraim Moses Lilian, often called the first Zionist artist. For me, this was a minor earthquake. I'd seen Jewish content in religious contexts, Haggadot, synagogue art, and I'd seen Jewish history in Holocaust units and books, and I'd seen Jewish stereotypes in media. But here was a Jewish artist inside the mainstream design canon, using the dominant visual language of his time to project a Jewish future. Lilian's work blends Japanese ukiyo-e print influences from the 19th century and Art Nouveau aesthetics with Zionist symbols and Hebrew typography. He draws upright, muscular, idealized Jewish figures standing in a renewed land of Israel. He also draws bent, weary diaspora figures in cramped European spaces. The images don't just describe Jewish experience at the time. They compare it to one that could possibly be attained. They say, here is the before and here is the after. Here is who we could become. At the time, I didn't have the visual, the term visual prototyping in my head, but that's just what this is. Lilian is prototyping a new Jewish body, a Jewish landscape, and a Jewish aesthetic. Not in theory, but in posters and book plates and fundraising graphics that people see, hold, and pin to their walls. If you look closely, the tech in these drawings is symbolic. Stars arranged like interface elements, Hebrew letters acting like circuit traces, rays and halos behaving like spiritual user interfaces around the figures. It feels like concept art for a future operating system where text, people, and land are all wired together. Two Lilian images have never left my imagination. One is Avram Counts the Stars, this lone figure looking up into a sky thick with beautiful stars, the whole page bending and swirling around his gaze. You can feel promise and loneliness at the same time. The other is Lilian's Dybbuk image. A Dybbuk is a Jewish ghost, where the spirit clings to a body with this almost electric line work. When I first saw them, I kept flipping back to these pages. It was like someone had taken Jewish myth and turned up the volume and contrast all the way into punk rock level. I was just so excited about this. And then after Lilian, I stumbled into the story of the Bezalel School in Jerusalem, with whom he was connected. And it felt like the institution that belonged to those images. Bezalel was founded in 1906 by Boris Schatz, a sculptor who came to Ottoman-era Jerusalem with a very particular dream. The school's mission wasn't just teaching drawing or train craftspeople. It was to forge an authentic Jewish style for a modern Jewish society in the land of Israel. The name is already a clue. Bezalel ben Uri, in the Torah, is the Exodus artisan who designs and builds the Mishkan, the portable tent, the sanctuary that the Israelites carried through the desert before entering the land. I sometimes call him the art director of the Mishkan generation. Naming this art school Bezalel is a way of saying we're going to design something so much more than a building. We're going to design the visual and material culture of modern Jewish life. Amazing. In practice, early Bezalel brought together European styles like Art Nouveau and arts and crafts, biblical and Near Eastern motifs, menorahs, lions, palm trees, scenes of Jerusalem, Hebrew lettering and calligraphy, and new Zionist narratives and landscapes. Students weren't just learning to make pretty objects. They were learning how to look deep into the heritage of the Jewish people in Israel and the diaspora and remix tradition into modernity, into a coherent national aesthetic. Then you put that next to Schatz's novella, Jerusalem Rebuilt, A Daydream, where he imagines waking up in a future Jerusalem about a century ahead of his time, so about 2018. In that dream world, art and craft, Bezalel-style work, are not side hobbies. They sit at the center of the city's economy and spiritual life. There is an art school museum hybrid that reads like a modern temple to Jewish creativity. Everyday ritual objects are treated like speculative devices. a kiddish cup as a portable memory bank, a wall hanging as a low-tech augmented reality layer that tells you which story you're standing in. Amazing. To me, that's where Bezalel crosses into what we'd now call Jewish futurist territory, for sure. It's not just an art school reacting to the present. It's an institution explicitly trying to prototype the look and feel of a Jewish future and then mass-produce pieces of it in souvenirs, ritual objects, architectural elements that circulate back into the diaspora and forward into the utopian imagined state. I'm embarrassed to admit I hadn't even heard of the Bezalel School until about 10 years ago. I'd already been teaching graphic design history for more than two decades. I know, I'm ashamed. I knew the big Israeli posters from the Palestine Poster Project, but Bezalel wasn't in the official canon I'd been given. Once I realized there had been this early 1900s design school whose mission sounded exactly like the things I think about now, I got a little angry and a lot of obsession happened. I dug deep. I went down that rabbit hole. For at least 5 years, I've made sure every history course I teach includes a lesson on Bezalel and early Zionist posters. If the canon won't make room, then I will. Thank goodness I saw Lillian in the Meg's book. Thank goodness. Now, I want to pull you out of the studios and the classrooms of the creative futurist thinkers and onto the street, because none of this happened in a vacuum. Okay, picture a newsstand on a European city street around 1905, 1910, right? Kind of in the background, you hear like, auga, like from things, as well as horses, you know, going down the street. On the rack of this newspaper kiosk, there's a Hebrew paper serialized from Palestine. There's a Yiddish daily newspaper translated from New York. There are Zionist pamphlets, socialist pamphlets, religious journals, and mixed into that, in some places, are pamphlets or reprints of a document called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Protocols is a pseudographic or a fake piece of text pretending to be real publication. And it's also a twisted response to the same Jewish question, where Herzl hears, "What do we do about the Jews?" and answers with a blueprint for Jewish self-determination. The authors of Protocols flip that into paranoia. They imagine a secret council saying, "We don't have a problem. We are the problem. We already run the banks, the press, the revolutions." It turns Jewish vulnerability into a cartoon of Jewish omnipotence. It's written like the minutes of a secret strategy meeting. You get this invented Elder of Zion voice speaking in first person plural, boasting about how we, quote unquote, will control the press, and we will crash economies, and we will turn non-Jews into our servants. It plagiarizes early political satire, strips out the original context, and recasts it as a Jewish world domination blueprint. It's fiction presented as fact, and then reproduced, translated, and circulated widely. The speculative tech here isn't ray guns, it's the media itself. The plan, quote unquote, in Protocols relies on newspapers, banks, telegraphs, railroads, all the tools of modern life. And then the booklet rides the same tools like a virus piggybacking on the system it pretends Jews already control. What matters for our story is not the details of its lies, but the media fact. It rides the same wave of cheap print and mass literacy that Jewish newspapers, Zionist novels, and design imagery ride. Ephemera that sticks to your eyes and your brain like sludge. So on one side, you have Herzl, Schatz, Lillian, and the Bezalel School using print and imagery to say, here is a Jewish future we are trying to build. Cooperative, creative, rooted. On the other side, you have anti-Semites using the same tools to say, here is the Jewish future you should fear. Secret control, manipulation, domination. Both are speculative. Both are futures of a kind. One is aspirational and the other is weaponized. When I realized that these two streams were concurrent, I stopped reading about early Zionist world building as just utopian optimism, just full of naivete. It started to look like counter-programming, a refusal to let the only circulating story about Jewish agency be a nightmare written by other people? No thanks. The first time I read about the protocols of the Elders of Zion, it felt physically gross inside my body. Not just because it's a lie, but because of who helped spread it. Learning that later Henry Ford reprinted the protocols in his Dearborn newspaper for a fresh American audience made my stomach turn. Here I was reading Herzl and Schatz and thinking about them carefully designing Jewish futures, and at the same time, this forged future plan, quote unquote, was being mass marketed as proof that Jews were plotting to run the world. It made the Zionist world building feel even riskier and even more defiant. So to make this digestible, I'd like to break what these figures are doing into a few types of creative moves. First, there's utopian blueprinting. That's Alta Neuland and Jerusalem Rebuilt. They are not just vibes. They are detailed sketches of possible societies, how power in society flows, how work is organized, and how culture operates in a new space. You could almost treat them like early UX user flows. But for a nation, Alta Neuland, which literally means the old new land, gives you a co-op power plant. Jerusalem Rebuilt by Schatz gives you moving sidewalks and an art-driven economy. Amazing. They're asking, if I wire the system this way, does life feel more humane? Second, there's visual prototyping. That's Lillian's illustrations and Bezalel's objects made by students. They take elements of tradition and modernity and combine them into tangible prototypes of a future Jewish world. You can wear them, hang them, pray with them, send them as souvenirs to your mishpacha, your family. A Bezalel Kiddush cup or a Lillian poster is basically a little chunk of a future timeline that you can hold right now. Third is what I'd call technological ethical parables. This is where stories about golems or machines or later robots function as thought experiments. If we create new forms of power or life, what responsibilities do we have to it? You see that line move into the 20th century science fiction and media theory, including Walter Benjamin, who we talked about in episode 9. The golem in Prague, the robot in mid-century story, the AI assistants on your phone right now, they're all stand-ins that let us ask, if we make a new kind of power, what kind of owner will we be? And then hovering over all of that are weaponized futures like protocols. Forge narratives about Jews as architects of a dystopian tomorrow. They matter because they form the hostile backdrop against which Jewish futurist projects have to speak against. Protocols is like a dark mirror Alta Neuland, a fake blueprint for Jewish power that never existed but still shapes how some people read every Jewish institution in the world. When I map myself onto these modes, I honestly feel like I can span all of them. My process starts with meditation to imagine things. I use illustration to capture the image before it disappears from my mind. I use coding to simulate how something might work. And then I use physical prototyping to put it into people's hands. If I have to pick one center of gravity, though, I'm a prototype person. I want to build new spiritual objects and not just talk about them, frankly. I want things that you can pick up, wear, tap, or stand inside to make a different Jewish future feel tangible for 1 second. So why am I telling you all this on a show that also talks about AI, the aura of art, and mixed reality? Because our situation right now rhymes with the people I'm talking about. Our tools are different. We have neural nets, social media feeds, VR, but the pattern is very familiar. And any systems designer will tell you, you learn from earlier builds. You read all sides of the argument in Judaism, don't we? We live with technologies that make it easy to generate, copy, remix, and distribute images, stories, and sounds. We live with political and social instability that makes the question, do Jews have a future here, feel less hypothetical than we'd like. We live with a flood of anti-Semitic narratives online, including repackaged versions of those same old conspiracies that Herzl, Schatz, and Lillian faced just over 100 years ago. We also live with incredibly creative capacity. Amazing Jewish artists, Coders, educators, and organizers are using these tools to make new rituals, new interfaces, new stories. I want to lift up Safaria.org as a significant achievement in Jewish culture today. It's a globally accessible set of Jewish canonical texts put into a digital rhizome, haha, I love that word, of links and commentaries that further democratizes the Talmud Midrash commentary tradition. And it puts it in the hands of every keyboard and touchscreen of every Jew in the world everywhere. That's Jewish futurism in action. So good job, y'all. A designed environment that changes who gets to learn and who gets to speak. Looking back at Herzl, Schatz, Lilium, and Bezalel, I see models for what Jewish futurism can be now. Not just prediction, but elegant and meaningful design. Not just anxiety, but blueprinting and prototyping better possibilities. Not just reacting to hatred, but pro-Semitism. Proactive articulation of the futures we want to inhabit, instead of just defending ourselves inside other people's designed nightmares. No, thank you. For me personally, learning about these people was a way of realizing that my impulse to treat design as a kind of Jewish practice, to think about ritual objects, interfaces, and images as a part of how we build Jewish future life, is not an eccentric tangent that I'm on. I'm not on my bullshit here, y'all. It's part of a long, messy, beautiful tradition of Jews trying to write themselves into tomorrow as a way of dealing with the anxiety of uncertainty. My clearest this is my version of Bezalel moment, came making a series of pieces in my studio almost a decade ago. The first was a futurist self-portrait. I painted myself with blue skin and wrapped my head in a holographic tallit scarf that works kind of like a spacesuit, this vehicle that can sling me through time and space and story. Right after that came my cosmogranite piece and my Hamsa shield, and these felt like artifacts from a Jewish future that hasn't happened yet. I was totally channeling comic great, the king, Jack Kirby's Fourth World and his New Gods comics. Super hard in those days. Cosmic drama, glowing glyphs, mythical tech. At some point, looking at those pieces lined up, I realized this is my tiny Alta Neuland, my little Bezalel. I'm not just depicting Jewishness, I'm stress testing what Jewish ritual gear could be in our next timeline in the future. So that's where I want to leave y'all today. In that crowded, noisy, early 20th century European street with a newsstand stocked with newspapers and pamphlets, hauga, in a Bezalel workshop full of hammers and brushes and Jewish joy. In a classroom where a textbook suddenly shows you a Jewish artist you didn't know you were missing. So in future episodes, we'll keep tracing this line forward into things like golems and AI ethics, into early sci-fi magazines with lots of robots and Jewish writers in space, into mixed reality and digital aura. For now, I hope this gives you a sense of how deeply Jewish futurism is rooted. Not in abstract theory, but in very specific people who picked up the media of their time and said, we're still here, and we intend to have a tomorrow. Appreciate y'all. Thanks for being in the lab with me today. Bezrat Hashem, I will see you in the next episode. This is Mike Wirth, the Jewish Futurism Lab.